We have on the line Barry Pateman. Barry Pateman was recently in Santa Cruz. He's a historian, anarchist. He is in charge of the Emma Goldman Papers at UC Berkeley. He's an activist, picketer, speaker, most recently in Santa Cruz for Demystifying Anarchism Council, the conference that was held at Loudoun Nelson. And Barry is an author. He has several books: Sister of the Road, the autobiography of Boxcar Bertha, as told by, he can let us know, Sleck Bastard, Anarchism and Anarchy, a Historical Perspective, the American Experience. And he's also been on PBS, YouTube. He's an interviewer himself, and I was able to hear his interview of Noam Chomsky. So, Barry, we have a lot of questions to ask you. The co other co-host, his name is Freedom. I'm Coral Reef, and you're on
Hi.
the Free the Land show in Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
Hi, Barry.
Glad to be here.
All right. I'm having a little difficulty hearing. Let me see here.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I can hear you.
Okay. I'll try and speak this loud, and if you begin to lose me, let me know.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, I gotcha. All right. Well, we got everything mic'd up, I hope. Okay. I'm
Hi,
ready.
Barry.
Hi. Nice to hear you.
Yes, it was really good to hear you too when you came to Santa Cruz. You were one of four panelists, I think. How was it that you were asked to come?
Oh, I think I know some of the people who down in Santa Cruz around Sub Rosa. I like the work they're doing there, and I've met them socially. And I guess I was the mug after they'd run out of all possible other people to ask to come down. So it was nice and interesting, and I enjoyed every minute of it.
Yeah, we heard you speak. We thought you were pretty good.
I thought you were more than pretty good. I could relate to a lot of what I heard there. But I know Freedom has some questions. I'm going to get my notes together.
But you're also a historian on anarchy, right?
Yeah, a little, yes.
Yeah, I kind of enjoy history. I've been reading a little bit of Blood of Spain about the Spanish Civil War, because that's one of the two times in history when anarchism reached a mass movement. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the other one was,
yes,
like
it was.
Chicago. And in Spain, they actually kind of took over power for a while because the fascists had...
Well, they had, yes. They certainly were very prominent and had all sorts of internal problems and debates about just what you said, that whole question of taking over power.
Because that's kind of a difficult thing, because anarchism is against having authority over other people in general. Correct?
Yes. Yes, very much so. Yet in the case of the Spanish Revolution at times, some of the anarchists did take what you and I guess, will call authority roles. They felt the circumstances dictated it. They didn't have a choice. You know, De Rutte, who was one of the most famous Spanish anarchists, you know, was essentially a military commander. Cipriano Mera and others literally led certain brigades. And all of that caused tension in the anarchist movement, as I'm sure you know through your reading.
Yeah, because they didn't believe in hierarchies, and military control generally involves that. I kind of want to talk.
That's right.
Talk about like a revolution. That was a revolution. I mean, it was the fascists doing the revolution at first, but that allowed the anarchists, it weakened the government and allowed the anarchists to have a revolution of their own.
Yes. Yes, it did. I mean, it meant that in the rural areas, it meant that they could actually simply create cooperatives of in Andalusia, for instance. Instead of the land being privatized, it went into workers' and peasants' cooperatives. And after that, in Barcelona, things like the tramways, things like shoe factories, weapon factories, metal factories, all became run by workers' councils and workers' cooperatives.
And that's, I wanted to explore this in a sense of, like, if there was a revolution today, what would it look like? How would it happen? And to start off with, who would it benefit? Who does anarchism benefit among the population? Certainly not the fascists or the extremely wealthy.
No, it doesn't. I mean, anarchism, however one wants to broach it, I think, and of course, other anarchists can speak for themselves. Anarchism, as you know, is not an homogenous movement. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to sort of describe. But for myself, the anarchism will benefit the exploited, the poor, the dispossessed, the lumpen proletariat. It will probably empower and excite some elements of the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't see it benefiting anyone who has got their wealth on the backs of other people's works and labor. I just don't see that happening.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be anarchism then.
So that would be the enemy of anarchism then, too. They're going to try and repress
it. Well, it would certainly not be their friend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not for those giving orders, but for those the taking of orders. And were you involved with the unions and picketing?
Yes, I was. I mean, in various times in my life, I've been involved in lots of strikes as for myself. And then, obviously, in terms of strike support, anarchists, in, certainly in England, where I came from, and anarchists maybe in other countries, have more of a presence, I think, in the unions
mm-hmm.
than here. Although I think anarchists would be the first to critique and argue that unions can be, you know, another, really just the left wing of capitalism. They're not really revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
They keep the capitalist system going. I think many of them, though, would see that there are hidden benefits to unions that people aren't aware of. And that's where people congregate and work. And it's often where it's that first point of contestation, that first point of argument with authority, if you like, with the state, but often just simply with authority, with those people who are making their money off the backs of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Union activity, strike support, claimants union work, yeah, did it all when I was younger and I was full of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Rent strikes, you know, anywhere you could that challenged the sense that people felt entitled to treat other people in this way, to exploit and to diminish them. You took them on whenever you could in any way.
And that's also during the Spanish Civil War. That was, it was a lot of union activity, the CNT and the FAI and stuff were anarchist organizations.
Yes.
And that's how they brought people into anarchism. And I also read there was affinity groups or, I mean, I'm wondering, how do you reach people today? Like we were talking.
Well, that's a huge question. I mean, you're right. I mean, in terms, one of the things we know about the CNTE and about the FAI is that they were really congregated in working class communities. And if you look at the FAI, for instance, the Federation of Iberian Anarchists, really, mm-hmm. what it stands for, rather militant, as you said, organized in affinity groups, friendship groups, people who, young men, always really young men until Mujer Libres began, the free women,
mm-hmm.
All grouped literally within streets of growing up with each other.
So it's neighborhoods.
These young men had grown up in the same barrios, they've been to the same schools, they often worked in the same factories, and they certainly lived in the same streets. Sometimes an affinity group of the FAI were simply brothers. And they gave themselves names, you know, the bastards, the uncontrollables, ourselves, just us, and all sorts of names. The point I'm getting round to, of course, is that we do know that anarchism had two periods of strength, three maybe if we look in some elements of Southern America. But let's talk about, say, Chicago that you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and Barcelona and Spain in 1936. It was essentially grounded in working class communities. It was part of the everyday life of people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think maybe the problem is that anarchism isn't that now.
No.
Or it's having difficulty in being that.
It's more of a cultural.
It is, in some senses, a culture of its own.
Yeah.
It's a part. It certainly is exciting. It's sometimes really interesting to be involved with. and certainly sometimes frustrating. But the one area I sense where it's not particularly strong anymore is in those communities that are still being exploited, that are still being dispossessed. There isn't an organic or anarchist movement at the moment coming out of there. And I think that's going to be the hugest hurdle for any radical movement or any movement that looks at the empowerment of ordinary people to break that huge cultural gap that's there, and indeed that class gap that's there. So I think that there's a lot of work for anarchists to do in to reach out and to talk to, I guess, what we'd call ordinary people. People who just get up, go to work, go to bed, and in many cases don't get up and go to work because there's no jobs, or that the jobs they do are so soulless that they don't bother going anymore, and they sit around and have a drink and put the TV on and do whatever they want to do. And in some way, I fear, anarchism is not part of that, has got no way of talking to people who are enduring that life. And I think your question, how do we bring around some change? How do we reach out to people? Well, we have to work out where those people are. What are they doing? Why aren't they involved? Where is that desolation coming from? And what role do we have in creating that desolation? There's huge problems to face. We've lost that organic base that we had in stronger times. Sorry, I went on a bit too long.
For a time, there was a boycott rent action going on in Santa Cruz. That's what a lot of people have in common, because there's always someone to pay to.
Exactly. And those, I think, are marvelous things, because at the very least, it gives people a sense of what's possible. I think that no matter how poor, for instance, you might have been in, say, living in Barceloneta in 1935 in Spain, when you went to the sort of Atenados, the cultural centres there that the Cenote ran, you had a sense of what was possible from those discussions and those talks. There was another way of being, another way of operating with human beings. And I think that sense of what is possible, we need to project as much as possible ourselves. And if there are rent strikes, and goodness knows that people are nearly starving in some areas of our cities, if there are rent strikes, great. And I think it's a good thing, an exciting thing, and something worth supporting in every way we can.
That would be a very common bond among a lot of people if it could be going.
Absolutely.
Barry, that's gets back to like in before it used to be the unions, because working conditions were so horrible. But, you know, because of the earlier struggles, you know, we've been offered reforms. And so there's, you know, less of a drive there. But as we were saying with the rent strikes, you live in the Bay Area. Rent here and real estate prices are incredibly high. I mean, that maybe that's an area where it could be more effective. I guess this, what I'm getting at is people are going to, what's in it for me? You know, what would an anarchist revolution, after the revolution, what would an anarchist society look like to someone?
Well, that's a difficult question. I mean, I guess if I could answer it, I'd be maybe a better theorist and writer than I am, or a thinker anyway. I don't really know. I can give some examples
from the
of
pastor.
What I think it would be like, and the feeling of what it would be like, but I can't be totally not so precise, but I'll give you a shot if you want free. Let's imagine that, like in 1983, 84, 85 in England, whole communities are on strike based around the coal mines. Okay? During that time when there's a strikes going on, the communities are pretty solidly behind that strike. What happens is money begins to come in, either strike pay from the unions or money from supporters. Food comes in, clothes are being sent. What happens is that communities organize committees who look after that money, who divvy it out or share it out from each according to their ability, to each to their need. If you've got a big family, you get more money, you get more clothes. If you're single and you're a couple, then what you do is you get less money. You see people slowly but surely taken over the running of their everyday lives. The shopkeepers come to the union branch meetings and say, look, I can give this amount of money before they come and get me, the people I'm renting this shop with. So let's come and get this food now and we can work on what's going to happen in the future. Everybody begins to think about making decisions, not just about the strike, not just about the strike will go on, but what are we going to do now we've got no money, or what shall we do today? I know, we'll all just go somewhere, we'll go to the seaside today, and you know, we'll get some friendly coach drivers, and all of a sudden people are taking decisions and thinking about decisions, and what they're doing is they're caring for other people besides themselves. They're not just talking about it, they're not just passing a bill somewhere that they hope will get through. The little old lady two branches, you know, two streets down the road, who's been ill and hasn't got anyone to look after her, and has actually been like that when normal life has been going on. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden there's people knocking on door and taking her out and sitting with her. There's a change in how you view human beings and what they can do. Now, I didn't hope with every bit of my being that that's what might happen in the future. Mm-hmm. I know, though, and this is the tricky bit, that it's going to be almost impossible to say that will really happen that sweetly. The other thing I would say is that, of course, time and time again, the examples I could give are when communities are on strike or are taking some type of defensive action. It's not often offensive. It's they're not leading something, they're fighting back against something that's been done to them.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really interesting is that those moments, they're charged almost emotionally. A French writer called them the orgasms of history, where somehow, for some time, people managed to change their everyday existence and see this richness and possibility that's been hidden for them. The problem is with orgasms, unfortunately, they don't last.
They don't last too long. Yeah, that gets into when is it possible for an anarchist to grab. As I looked over history, it seemed to be the government had just lost a war, or there was a civil war happening or something. So
yes,
it was in a
yes.
weakened state, and that allowed the people to take over some of
yes.
the functions.
Certainly, even if you look not so much at anarchist history, but say radical, you know, if you want to call the Bolsheviks radical, certainly war has played its part. Certainly an awareness that the state is not as strong as it used to be, and a growing belief amongst people that things just have to change. However we want to see it, it has to change.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes change happens when countries like Britain, or countries even like Spain, push themselves too far, you know, they extend themselves too much, and that's sometimes bigger countries, Russia, just go so far that they begin to collapse internally in the center. And certainly I think if we're pretty sharp, we can read history and find certain paths and patterns.
Yeah, because I mean that's another thing about revolution. I mean, it puts a lot of people at risk. It's not the time to be making mistakes, and maybe we can learn from history what the correct
yeah.
path is. But I've
yeah.
also noticed that it's usually the government is dependent on the working class to fight the
yeah.
war for them. So all of a sudden they have weapons in their hands, and then they say, you know,
yeah.
why are we
yeah.
fighting for these guys that have
yeah.
been oppressing us? Why not just turn it on them?
But there's what's also interesting, though. There are times when. A lot of times countries are looking to the working class to take, you know, to fight for them, and the working class have got weapons in their hands and nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
People come home and it's as like there hasn't been a war.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to look at those times as well and try and work out, well, why in this case didn't that happen? It's an enormously complicated thing. But the main factor, I would say, is that it seems to me that most revolutionary changes on a societal base have certainly surprised all, shall we say, people like myself, people who've been reading history or interested in radical change. And it certainly surprised political groups like the Bolsheviks never expected 1916 or 17 to occur. Never expected it at all. They were caught as napping as anyone. It was a spontaneous surge of anger and resentment. And I think often the professional radicals, if you like, are going to be caught just as much by surprise as the right wing.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, then you don't know what to do because you really haven't planned for winning, you know.
No, no. And it's very difficult. You know, we don't want to be too miserable, you know, but we do know that many revolutions, so-called revolutions, have quickly ossified and solidified into pretty unpleasant states, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. Cole, do you have a question?
Well, there's currently this activist organization at the, I would call it, I guess, anarchistic. It's going on at the courthouse, Santa Cruz County, seat of Santa Cruz County. What can anarchists give to the homeless? There's a peace camp going on there. They've taken over the land for their own use, so I guess I would call that an anarchist action where they've been there about 30 days and they seem to be getting you know, what they need and a lot of attention for it. So
well, what are they doing there? Sorry, why are they, are they making a point, or they've just decided this is a good time to take this action?
It's illegal to sleep in Santa Cruz, so they're they're protesting that by sleeping
what,
in the courthouse.
Outside, I mean. It's not that bad, is it? You have to. You're not allowed to sleep outside.
Between 11 and 8:30 at night.
Not cover with a blanket.
And you can't
have
a blanket either. That's a separate infraction.
So, does Santa Cruz have really well-appointed and very nice, host and safe, comfortable hostels for people to stay in?
No.
They're generally filled to the capacity.
They have shelters, but they're always full, yeah.
Right. And, okay, so what a strange law then.
Uh-huh, exactly.
And how almost lacking in humanity.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, I'm surprised and really quite horrified. So what do they expect the people to do who can't get into the hostels? I presume they don't want them in their town, is that right?
That's the general goal, but they're kind of stymied because it's extremely poor people, so they give them a ticket, they don't have any money to pay the ticket, and they just ignore it. So they've got a new law where if you ignore three tickets on the fourth one, they can send you to jail for up to a year for sleeping.
Right. Well, that sounds a really, really good use of society's funds, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And they want it to be settled in the courts, which is a big waste of time.
That's
and
why it's at the
resources.
Courthouse, too. Yeah, it's also on county grounds, so it's outside the jurisdiction, so they've been having, that's why it's lasted so long.
Right. And they are making a point that they can sleep out, is
mm-hmm,
that right?
Mm-hmm. But then again,
right. Well, I mean, yes.
It is.
I mean, certainly if they're camping out, sharing. Again, you have a little possibility of what could be.
Yeah, it's a community that's developed, yeah.
And you know, the one thing that we could say is that, and I don't wish to really, I don't know enough about the Santa Cruz political situation in any way, but it seems to me that any society that is not predicated on humanity and care for people, it is something that needs to, at the very least, be challenged. We can't dehumanize people who mm-hmm. haven't got money or anywhere to live. And we don't want to listen to silly stories about how they're wealthy, really, or they go around professionally. There are huge amounts of poor people around California. And the idea that you can penalize them because they've nowhere to live.
Mm-hmm.
It's bad enough not having anywhere to live, I'd have thought. Not to get punished for it as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I hope that there will be eventually some type of big popular response to it.
Yeah, they're what do you say?
They're getting in the news a lot. I mean, the people of Santa Cruz, I mean, though it hurts their home values to have homeless people spare changing. I guess it's the merchants downtown mostly, the spare change. So it's kind of a form of fascism. The merchants downtown are kind of in league with the government on this. And
this piece of land, Is there the jurisdiction is a county. For debate? It's a county owned, but it's in within the city.
Limits,
so
yeah.
Right.
Each group doesn't want to venture into giving anybody any trouble.
Well, and, they'd like to get rid of them, but they're in a little legal problem. So that's why it's been able to last. But, you know, we even have he claims to be socialist mayor, but he doesn't want homeless in town.
Socialists and anarchists do not get along.
If there are truly socialist mayors and socialist councillors, then I'm sure one would hope that they are actively working to improve the quality of hostels, to build new hostels, and to encourage those people to be able to, who are on the road or outside at night, to be able to sleep in these hostels. And for those people who can't get into a hostel because there aren't enough, they're going around with food and drink and looking after them in the evening.
Well,
yeah, they
not.
Have no other alternative.
They'll be doing that as good socialists.
He just teaches classes on socialism and Marxism up at the college, but he doesn't actually practice it in any way. He claims it's just
under
unions.
Sad.
It's just ironic. But there is it is somewhat anarchy, though. I mean, there are people that, you know, drunks that come in at 3 a.m, make all kinds of noise. I mean, how can they deal with that, you know? And
well, who can deal with that?
I mean, the homeless that are camping there.
Well, my sense is if the drunks come along, you have to be, are the drunks homeless people?
Yes.
Then you have to have a long, long word with them, and sometimes maybe an aggressive one. And I do aware, I come from a background in a culture where antisocial behavior was often very, very quickly challenged.
Oh, that's been very quickly challenged.
That's kind of what's going on, but we're not supposed to talk about that. Yeah, they really don't have a door. Like, everybody else can close a door to keep troublesome people out.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And it becomes difficult, but it has to be dealt with because, you know, and the drunken homeless guys, they're having as much fun as they can, I'm sure, because they haven't got much else to do. But, you know, there has to be a lot of talking to them and a lot of explanation. And remember that, you know, in 1886 and in the 1930s in England, there were tramp unions that were sort of organized and worked on by anarchists.
Hmm.
Where the tramps had always, you know, friends and comrades who would look after them in different towns, and they created unions and made sure that improvements in hostels and extra hostels were built for them.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't their fault they were unemployed. It wasn't their fault. It's very easy to say it's their fault, but it wasn't their fault. And people like Bill Gape and other good English comrades were really active in making sure that tramps were treated with respect and dignity. And they adopted the name tramps themselves. I don't know what the correct term is, but it seems to me that all those people that you're seeing, and it's something I feel about quite strongly, and no matter how, I know that people can be frightening and you can be quite intimidated at times if you're not used to seeing, you know, 4 or 5, 7 or 8 gangs of people drinking or shouting. But all those people are essentially, and I'm not going to be too emotional about it, but they are the failures of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
They are the people who have not made it in this system. Just like the prisons are full of people who haven't made it. And we can't keep hiding them and pretending they don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the truth, isn't it, really?
Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, does capitalism have to be eradicated for there to be success? Or is there
another way? Think that if you've got a world that exists primarily for the profit motive, where making money and as much money as you can is seen as good, is seen as the right thing to do, then you're going to always, I think, have problems. I can't see how such a system which celebrates financial reward, that celebrates wealth, that celebrates the accruing of enormous wealth at times, and mm-hmm. says that is a good. I don't see how that type of society can truly be ever a humane, a caring, or a supportive one.
Mm-hmm. Now that's why there's a little socialism.
Some of those words I've just used there are almost oxymoronic when we put them next to capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, obviously, other people will disagree, but I really do not see how a society that's based on, that predicated on that principle, that we, you know, we should make money and keep making money and look after money, no matter what it does to the earth, what it does to humanity, what it does to individual human beings, that's going to be very difficult to ever argue that it's a caring and loving society.
No, it has to be watched. That is an anarchist philosophy, though, the anti-capitalism, much in the same as Marxism.
Yes, except that, of course, you also, and this is where I'm afraid it always gets rather messy for us, it's also an anti-Marxist philosophy as well. We're not socialists, we're not communists, we don't believe that the party, or even the state, or even, you know, the local branch of the party can make things right. We don't think that's going to be the answer. If you wanted, again, to be rather emotional, probably just as many people who have identified themselves as anarchists have been murdered by Marxists as well as by capitalists.
Mm-hmm. Never turn your back on a Marxist vanguard.
No comment there. But that's always our problem. And that does, I mean, obviously, we all know people who believe that elements of Marx, workers' councils, or some elements of Marxist economics is really good, and they are kind, caring, sweet people who do an enormous amount of work for good. And we all know them. And they often don't even trumpet the fact that they're Marxists. But they're the people sometimes who turn up and speak well and help and give money and give time. The trouble is that, you know, there seems to be something inherent in some elements of Marxism that breeds this awful totalitarian characters that come from nowhere and suddenly become utter bastards in the way they treat people.
But that gets to the hierarchy in government, kind of, you know, if there's a pyramid and there's a juicy spot at the top, everybody's going to fight for that.
Yes, and often that comes, I think, and I have to think carefully about how to say this, with the belief that you have the answers.
Right.
Your party, your group, has read the important words, has sat and discussed them in for hours and hours. You've given your life to these beliefs. And you have the answers to make a better world. And those answers can't be critiqued. They can't ever be challenged because they're the answers. They're the right answers.
Mm-hmm.
If you challenge them, there's something wrong with you, and you are counter-revolutionary. You're counter the good of the people.
And need to
therefore
be eliminated
you're the
for
enemy.
The good. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to be fair, in monarchies, you know, they can't even trust their own family. It's one of the problems of power.
Yes, certainly, royal families have had their difficulties. I think we'd agree there.
Mm-hmm.
When you say, Barry, anarchism allows a person to be the best that possible they can be, what do you mean by that?
Well, I believe now, perhaps even more than I ever did as a young man. Now I'm old and, you know, done. I think that capitalism isn't just, you know, an economic problem. It's an emotional and a humane problem. Mm-hmm. I think the desire for a profit, even the fighting against capitalism, sometimes the expendability of human beings because they don't make a profit, all that, I think, warps and twists people. Now, look, I'm not one of those people who believe that if an anarchist society comes, everything will be perfect tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that capitalism, this society we're in, has created a lot of pain, a lot of hurt, and a lot of emotional damage in a lot of human beings. And I don't exclude anarchists from that either. I don't think anarchists are perfect, greatly formed human beings. We've all got our demons that have been shoved into us. Sometimes, you know, capitalism is in your head and my head, never mind outside. The way we treat the people we love, the constant, you know, struggles to be constantly decent. I think if you get rid of capitalism, I think that what you will get can't be much worse. I actually do believe that it will allow a lot of people, like ourselves maybe, who feel alienated, lost, lonely, the sad, the miserable, the people struggling in relationships that are brutal, the people who have got so much potential as writers, as thinkers, people who really do have so much to offer us all, and it's just been stunted and driven so deep inside their psyches, we never will see it. I think there could be so much more flourishing there,
mm-hmm.
If we were to be in a society that you and I would call anarchical.
I
would say, though, and let's be clear, that, you know, Free was saying there's been a couple of times where we've seen it, and it was rich and rather beautiful. But this is an act of faith as much as an act of rationality. And like many anarchists, I operate between the two. But I really do believe that to get rid of capitalism will free, maybe free some back, but it will free so much richness of potential in people. That's what I mean.
Well, I was going to say, I'm kind of new to anarchism, so I wanted to relate it back to like ancient history. To me, the closest is Athenian democracy. With direct democracy, that also empowers the oppressed, because usually the oppressed are the majority. And it was also a flowering in culture. It opened up people to, you know, have their own, they had more control over their lives and could come up with creative solutions. Whereas when you're under a hierarchical formation, it's usually the person at the top defines everything, so you're limited to by the amount of creativity they have, and everybody else has to go along.
I certainly think it's a possible role model. I worry a little bit about the slaves there.
But I certainly think
there have been times like that where we've seen segments look for that richness. And I think you're right. And I think one of the things, the reason history fascinates me so much now as I've grown older, and I'm so angry that I didn't find it when I was a younger man. You know, when we look at the levellers in the English Civil War, the diggers, when we see things like the Stelton Modern School here in the 1920s in New Jersey, all those little examples of richness and possibility. I go every year to the Modern School, the Anarchist School reunion, and just to hear 70, 80, even 90-year-old people talk about their youth and how they so revered it, how much they loved that freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 78-year-old woman called Voltairine after Voltairine de Cleyre, because their parents so revered her. And that richness there, there are times where it has happened, and we do well to be aware of it and to treasure it and to keep it in our minds for days to come. We need to not be so obsessed with the new,
mm-hmm.
and to forget what's happened in the past. That's my lecture over for the night.
It could be a blueprint for the future. You were talking about the diggers, and that's kind of what our show is based. It's Free the Land, and I make a little distinction. Uh-huh. I'm not so against capitalism. I just, when it gets big, I don't like it. But the land, you know, like the homeless could just have their own land. They, you know, they wouldn't worry too much about, you know, not having a job. They can spare change.
Yes.
And so I separate, you know, there's kind of lumped together all the time, the capitalists, because they end up owning the land because they have all the money. But if the land were equally distributed, say, every year, then that could relieve a lot of oppression. And it goes way back in history to like the pyramids. As soon as agriculture started, all of a sudden land became privately owned and you got, you know, marginalized.
Yes, the ability, you know, the ability to share land, to have the commons, to have it belong to us,
mm-hmm.
seems to me an incredible driving force. And I think you're right. Soon as people owned it, took it away, or kept it for themselves, you got, you know, the precursors to capitalism. You got that transfer from feudalism onwards, and you see the cementing of power, very much based on land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And you look at today, I mean, that's also the resources from land. I mean, it's oil, and then banking also, is they loan money against land. I mean, the Builder Group Habsburg group. You know, all the people involved, their royalty, oil, banks, all derived from that kind of taking. Whereas with capitalists, you know, they have to pay for the land, too. So maybe we can form a, you know, divide the landowning from the capitalists and defeat that.
Well, there's all sorts of strategies I think we can use. Even Henry George in the 1880s was saying, talking about the need for a single tax just on land, because land was so important.
And that's a tax that doesn't distort.
Yeah, I think there's all sorts of strategies, but that land and that ability to work that land and to have that land is going to be very important.
And that also gets back to, I think, like, that's the English Civil War. Once again, you know, it was a civil war. They needed the poor to help fight and maintain. And once they had the weapons, they said, well, why don't we, you know, run it ourselves? The beginning of anarchism, would you say, like, the first author, other than ancient times, would be, Goodwin, William Goodwin?
William Godwin. Some people would say that, yes. I mean, I veer whether or not Godwin is an anarchist. I think at times he was a very brave person, I really do. Or whether or not he's just what you might call a militant liberal. But I certainly think that in his work there are questions and thoughts and ideas that we need to interrogate and come to terms with and teach us things.
Because I think he was influenced by Thomas Paine, and that's another guy I like to play a lot on.
And I think there was a whole groups of, if you like, free thinkers, exciting, almost intellectual men and women who lived in London and around that time, who were looking at the world and making sense of it and questioning so much and arguing in a very rational way for a better life, a better world.
So, I mean, then it gets into... So he influenced the theory, and to me, there's a lot of theory in anarchism. That's why you say it was so vast. There's so many different forms of ego. Some of it's almost... you're primarily like a social anarchist, correct, from what you would say? It sounds that way.
I suppose so.
Like, there's that one branch where it's you can do whatever you want as long as you can get away with it, and... I guess.
Yeah.
Don't limit my options.
Sorry?
Where...
I lost you there,
people, Carol. Well, where people say, don't limit my options.
Oh, she's talking about violence.
Yeah. And,
that's another question. We had John Malkin on the show, and we just went to a lecture of his, and he believes in nonviolent anarchy. But in the past, violence has been used a lot in anarchy.
Yes. Yes. And there's... There's two or three reasons for that. I mean, I'm trying to be as objective as I can because, you know, one violence is such a tricky, awful thing to try and talk about, to make sense of. But there were certainly anarchists who took individual action from time immemorial against what they felt were cruel tyrants, usurpers. Mm-hmm. There were anarchists who took revenge against people who had executed their comrades or imprisoned their comrades or tortured their comrades, and the Senate especially did that, you know. Mm-hmm. They did take action against jailers they knew who had tortured their friends. We also know that society itself, and I'm trying not to be too dramatic, is often predicated on violence.
Mm-hmm.
It rests on violence.
Government.
The possibility of violence.
The threat of it is always
and
there.
People will fight back. Now, we can argue all sorts of arguments about whether they should, but sometimes it will happen. And it will happen because people are either A, justifiably so angry, so exhausted, so drained, and so incapable of seeing any positive way to change anything. I don't mean violence isn't positive, by the way. You know, history has sometimes shown that it is, and I don't wish to get into a contestation with John here and what he believes, because I think some of the things he does, or actually most of the things, is damned admirable. But I do think that my take on violence is slightly different. Emma Goldman argued that those attenters, who I've just been talking about, those people, they tend tatters, I'm sorry. People like Vaillant, Emile Henry, these were the most sensitive souls of a society that had been damaged by greed and capitalism more than any other, and we should understand them like that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to remember is, and again, without being too sweeping or generalised, I grew up in essentially a totally working class community. I never, the only middle class people I ever met were teachers. I never met anyone else, except for the odd policeman, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
And those cultures were often quite violent.
Right.
You know, getting drunk on a Saturday night, going into town and having a fight with someone from the next pit village was something you did. It sounds stupid, it sounds unreal, but that's what you did. And when people from those type of backgrounds enter the movement, they carry that with them. They won't take things lying down. They won't just say, okay, let's go and sit in a circle and discuss it. If they feel there's something wrong, something that is unjustified, they will challenge it physically. It seems to me something not to necessarily try and apologize for either. It seems to me that there is not one right way to bring around social change. The only thing we can ask is that it's done in a way whereby the ends justify the means, or the means justify the ends. We need to remember that anarchists don't take power, don't usurp power, don't use it in creating a new world, or don't use it to the extreme that we know it can be used. Don't use power, but try and remain anarchist in their practice. Because if not, it's going to be a hell of a strange world if we don't, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that we can use un-anarchistic methods to achieve anarchism. And by that I mean, I'm not sure that we can have elite cadres of anybody walking around, be it Bolsheviks, be it people wearing hoods and jackets, and seeing themselves as stormtroopers of the revolution. Because I think the real revolution will be met by people who are, we may never even know. It will be mm-hmm. made by people in the communities I've been speaking about, rather than us. And I think that's a damn good thing.
Mm-hmm.
All we can do is set the tone and show the possibilities. Hey, look, I'm going on far too much.
I'm relishing in this.
Shut me up for a bit now.
Well, we are going to open the phones around now. What was the phone number again, Carl?
It's 831-427-3772. We're talking with Barry Pateman. Hope you've been enjoying listening, and if you have any comments, please call. So, where do we go? Let's see.
So we're talking about the violence. That was an issue in the Spanish Civil War. I mean, the fascists, you know, use violence, and they'll always use violence. It's coming again, almost certainly. But the people weren't really prepared. There was a shortage of rifles.
Sure.
Although I was reading the anarchists preferred pistols and grenades for street fighting anyways.
Well, yes, I mean, they took a lot of stuff from the Civil Guard, and they buried stores of their own material.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they, I think, pretty accurately from about 34-ish onwards reckoned that they'd have to keep their own, they'd have to have their own weapons.
Oh, so they were stockpiling.
Well,
heard they grabbed
they were
some
trying
weapons
it
in
as
Barcelona.
Best they could.
Yeah,
but it's never as easy as it sounds, you know, I'm sure. And certainly I've interviewed a few old anarchists who were there on the 19th of July, and they had nothing, you
mm-hmm.
know, and they were all sort of, they were taken, literally, they were in some fights with some of the army units, and they were just taking the weapons from the army and running away with them. So they had tried, but things never work out the way you plan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that gets into something else, too. I mean, one of the big mistakes in both the Paris Commune and the Spanish Civil War is they didn't get the money out of the bank.
Yeah.
There was all that gold there
that you could have used
to get weapons.
Hi,
yeah.
Okay, let's get...
We've got a call here.
Oh, Lord.
Caller, you want to say your name?
My name is Barry.
And Barry... Welcome to the show.
You have a, Barry, you have a question for Barry?
Hi, hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, my question is, I've been a union activist for about 40 years, and at various times have worked with anarchists on specific issues, and I was wondering if you could say something about an example of an anarchist union. I know some co-ops are anarchist, but if you're already in a really bad union, it's difficult to desert and then reorganize and be able to negotiate contracts. And I mean,
there are various attempts, I think. Obviously, the IWW in America is trying. I think that, obviously, the Sanité, the CNT in Spain. There are also various COBAs, little groups and bases in Italy that have formed their own union. The many anarchists I knew, or certainly key anarchists I knew, were in the National Unions of Miners and stayed there. They felt it was right to stay in this mainstream union and fight for their ideas in that union. So I know very few, apart from the Sanité, and that is still pretty small after the troubles it had to undergo in the repression era of Franco and co. I know very few separate anarchist unions. There's the FAU in Germany, the FAU. There's the SAC, the SAC in Sweden. But even as an anarchist, I'd be the first to say they're not booming with membership.
Somehow I wish we could get the best of the, you know, the whole... I support labor notes, you know, the bottom-up union organizing, which is basically what the anarchists are. If we could work together to get the unions to function better, that would be fantastic.
Some of my colleagues in the anarchist world may think I'm hopelessly naive, but I actually think that unions serve a hugely important purpose.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very, very easy just to say, oh, these union leaders, they're crap. They're reactionaries. So, yes, they may be.
Yeah.
But in terms of unions offering support, solidarity, help in things like health and safety, never mind as weapons of the revolution, they're important areas.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah, and good luck with your work, and it's been ever so nice to talk to you.
You too.
I hope I'll see you down there one day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye. Okay, that was good.
Well, she sounded really nice. What she was doing listening to me rant on, I don't know.
Well, Barry's a good egg. Another Barry. Yeah. I think she used to work in the... I shouldn't go on about someone that just called, so anyway.
Right. But, you know, interesting. And I do think statements there about... You know, working in unions has got a lot's got to be said about that still. It's so easy just to criticize unions as being dead wood and part of the capitalist conspiracy. Well, maybe they are. But so a lot of those people in those unions are not like that. Anyway, yes.
There used to be an IWW meeting around Santa Cruz, but I don't know of any kind of anarchist groups that are even meeting here. And we had a gal come from Berkeley the other day for this conference, a little group that we were talking about, and she doesn't know of any in Berkeley.
Really? I think there is a reasonably strong IWW in Berkeley, and I think they've got, I believe anyway, they have one of their largest branches is the recycling workers.
You know, Barry,
I'll have to check that.
Ironically, this phone call is being paid more by a Salvation Army calling card.
That's very kind.
Very nice.
Back in the 30s, they were both competing for membership from the same class. And that's also the problem you have with the communists as well. You both appeal to the working class, so you're in competition.
Yes. And you know, there's all sorts of questions about that as well, you know, which is that I grew up really believing that the working class were the instruments of change.
Mm-hmm.
They were the group of people, even if they didn't know it, and my God, why didn't they know it? But they were the group of people that were the weak link of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of them, and they could break down capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, we shared in a sense that Marxist inevitability, I think, when I was a younger man anyway, that these were people who were destined to become the new world. It's not happened, you know.
Yeah,
now, there's hundreds of reasons we could go into, but it hasn't happened yet. And one of the questions that we still need to be thinking about, of course, is, well, what are the weak links? What is the weak link of capitalism?
They're inconsistent, greedy.
I'm going to say the banks.
Well, the question is, yes, I mean, the only thing I would say, and I think I may have mentioned it at the conference, was that I don't know, you two sound a lot bloody younger than me, but I certainly really did believe 40 years ago that capitalism was on its way out.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't sure what was going to replace it, but it just seemed so tired and exhausted.
The end of the 60s, you mean?
Yeah. And I've been amazed at just how resilient it is.
Yeah.
It just keeps coming back, you know? You know, there was... I remember a couple of radical groups thinking a year and a half ago that we were seeing its demise, you know, with the banking crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But it keeps coming back. Much more resilient.
That's right.
Much tougher than I ever believed.
But you know, the Bushes and the Rockefellers probably think how can we get rid of this socialism? There's always some socialism there. It's how your perspective is.
Yes, it is. But, you know, the there are fewer of them than of us.
Uh-huh.
You know, the potential us is a sea of human beings. And even when that sea has formed a little bit, where there has been a lot of us rather than a few of us holding the line, there's still only been a few of them, and they've held their position. They've been able to adopt and change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that anarchists don't do, is to study capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that it's wrong, or we believe it's wrong, but the way it works and the fact that it's survived for so long is something we need to look at.
Mm-hmm. It's been thousands of years, really. They say it started in the 1300s with the Knights Templar with their international banking. But really, it's been since the start of agriculture. As soon as you can accumulate some goods, you can use that to control other people.
Yeah.
Nomadic societies, you can only carry so much stuff and you have to move to another hunting ground. So there's not that much control over other people. They're more egalitarian and more anarchic societies in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's just, it survived and we need to figure out why.
Mm-hmm.
But that's maybe the topic for a whole other show you can do with lots of other people.
That's true. Well, another thing is you look at the people in charge, and a lot of them are members of secret societies, and secret societies have been with us since before the pyramids again. And
I certainly think they play their role.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are just able to, whether they're in a society or not, those positions become cemented. Those positions become all powerful, and it just seems to grow. And I'm sure societies play some role in that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Another thing, they have a promise to the middle class that they're going to move up, even though in these days the middle class is disappearing in this country, and the poor are growing. And that is the seeds for revolution. You know, as more and more people see that there's no hope, then they can.
I think you think. And hope that'll be the case. It'll either be that or it'll be whole-scale religion. I don't know. But I do think that, yes, I mean, capitalism has to deliver. Just like, you know, you would justifiably say, anarchism has to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't talk about it as being a wondrous marvelous thing and we can all live, you know, by the beach and be at one with the world. It has to create a world that the majority of us can celebrate and be part of. And capitalism has to deliver, and capitalism has to deliver by money, doesn't it, really?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe nice housing and conditions, but essentially money. And in some degrees it did. I mean, I grew up in a shockingly poor world. You know, I mean, our living conditions where I grew up were shocking. And so were a lot of other people's. And gradually that changed. And it seemed that capitalism was delivering the goods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people had, for instance, and this is not to be mocked. I mean, my mum got central heating. You know, when she was an older lady, and she was frozen for a lot of her life, just had a coal fire. And in some senses, it delivered the goods.
Mm-hmm.
And now it can't anymore, I don't think. But we'll to say, that's another program for you lot. You've got lots there and better people than me and more knowledgeable, I hope, to talk about it.
Well, we're kind of essentially, I study astrology and stuff, and we're repeating the same thing as the 30s. I mean, when you get that globalization, the jobs go overseas, the capitalists make the money on the trade, and your country gets weaker and weaker. And then that leads to revolutionary. But then after World War II, capitalism could deliver. You know, the living standards through the 50s and 60s were raised. But then in the mid 70s, the corporations started taking over and gradually take more and more of the pieces of the pie until there's nothing left for anyone else.
I agree.
And that's why the economy starts to fail, is because there's no demand anymore. You know, there's all those empty houses sitting there, yet people have to go camp on the courthouse steps in order to sleep. It's
yes, which is, to say the least, banal, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And that's the seeds of revolution, and it's the revolutionary's job to get out there and point that out, more so than breaking the windows. We had some window breaking here in town. That drew some attention to anarchy, definitely, but it doesn't really solve the problem. You know, the cops ended up with $1 million more in response to it. It kind of helps the other side.
Sure. Well, yes, but, you know, I grew up in an area where police cars were turned over every Saturday night, you know, because it was the only time on a weekend when a few of you had had a few bevies, a few drinks, that you could do that. And these people were not nice to you.
Uh-huh.
You know, they'd slap you, they'd push you, knock you around a little bit. This, remember, is in the middle 60s.
Uh-huh. Where was this?
And at times, those cars got turned over, or at times, things were thrown at them, or they were chased out. And that will happen. You know, that's going to happen, and we ought not to get, you know, sort of be unaware that it's going to happen. It's not something that is evil. It may have had a bad result, but sometimes, you know, passions, feelings, we can't always be rational. I wish we could, but we can't. Actually, I don't know if I do wish we could. Maybe I'm being daft there. But anyway, again, that's another topic. I had a chat at that meeting with one or two people who come because of that. I understand that the meeting we spoke at was really an attempt to tell people about what anarchism was, who maybe had been hurt or, you know, not hurt, but angered by the behavior of people on that demonstration. And it was quite interesting to talk to a couple of people. I think that there's something that we're going to have to accept, that we're not going to bring everybody with us, are we?
No. It is essentially propaganda of the deed, right? It's what happened there? If it was anarchist?
Oh, possibly. I mean, I wasn't there, and I don't know. I've only read and been told about it in not much. You're going to know more than I do. Certainly, propaganda by the deed, I suppose, could be construed as smashing windows. It can be construed as, you know, sabotage at work. It can be construed as sitting down in the middle of a road and, you know, protesting against a war. Doing something is always a propaganda of the deed. You know, peacefully walking around with banners is propaganda by the deed. You're doing something rather than sitting at home. And that phrase, propaganda by the deed, we like to... historians have tried to pretend it's just to do with violence, but people like Malatesta who began using that phrase earlier. So it is a whole range of things. But yeah, it could have been. I don't know who was there. I don't know who was doing it. I don't know if it was a group of kids who were just bloody angry and weren't particularly political at all and were just having a laugh. I thought it was fun to do.
Yeah, there was
or whether
no,
it was more than that.
There's no communique
and, you
after
know, again,
the event.
Those people who did it, I'm sure, can get on your show and talk to you about it.
Yeah, do you think it's if they'll ever will reveal why they did it or who it is? That's not been determined.
Well,
and
there's been no communique on it. But there was a communique prior to it, though, which I thought was very clever. That if it was the same people, there was a pamphlet came out beneath the levee that had some anarchistic ideas, and they talked about May Day and riots and how to beat the police in a riot and stuff.
It sure. was a warning about what would you do if there is ever a riot.
And it came out a couple days before, so I thought that was clever, because if they ever find out who did the pamphlet, they can always say, well, I had nothing to do with the riot.
Yeah.
But it did prepare
it
in the end.
How to conduct a... yeah.
Sounds good. Now, look, I'm going to have to leave soon.
All right. It's been great having you on, Barry.
Well, is there anything else? I want to say thank you, first of all, for putting up with me for an hour. You were really nice and patient with my ramblings, and I really enjoyed your questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed being on the show. Hope that... Yeah?
Oh, well, I'm very happy that you were able to talk to us and give us your perspective, because we're just this little beach community here that needs some help.
Not too many working
classes. Well, you've got a lot of exciting things going on there. Mm-hmm. I do think that places like Sub Rosa are really interesting in what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I like that.
I've admired them for a while. I've been there a couple of times, and I think there's a lot of commitment to good things there and caring things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people there who are humane in the real rich sense of that word. So you're not just a little beast. I think you've got people there who are doing exciting things. Not just challenging things, saying, oh, that's bad, and shouting, but trying to create whatever alternatives they can. And I think there's richness there that needs to be celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, thank you so much for having me and putting up with me. I've really enjoyed it. And as I say, I wish your show and I wish your station well. And I hope that people in Santa Cruz continue to support you and increase their support for you. Because it's great to have places like you where alternative voices can be heard and alternative voices can be sort of listened to and discussed.
Absolutely.
Thanks for adding yours very much.
All right, it's a pleasure. Now you take care of yourselves down there. We'll
All right.
see each other soon, I hope.
Oh, yeah, okay. We hope so.
See you later, Barry.
Take care.
Thank you. You too. Okay. Yes, that was really a wonderful talk we just were able to have with Barry. I have a Cree Indian prophecy to read now. Only after the last tree has been cut down, only after the last river has been poisoned, only after the last fish has been caught, only then will you find that money cannot be eaten. So what do we have next? I think if you have any comments, you could call in 427-3772.
Maine is quoted as saying the following about the militia man: almost every man is his own master and a general. With militia officers democratically elected, quote, the notion of liberty so generally prevails that they are impatient under all kinds of superiority and authority, end quote. This further goes to illustrate the benefits of seeing all men as men and not sovereigns over oneself. Militiamen from Massachusetts were notorious for assassinating and mutinying against officers who were not cooperative of what they wanted, or attempted to go beyond leader to become their ruler. It is the love of freedom and friends which drives the militiamen, not the whip.
Publicly subsidized. rise privately, profitable, the anthem of the upper-tier, untouchable, focus a moment, not in approval, bury our heads in the bargains of these neo-colonials. A former nemesis, a woman of the nation-state, now place a place for a new man, never concentrate. Try again, but now we'll confuse what is class war. Is it class war? Yes, this is class war.
Hermanos, la guerra, tiranos y los reguetes. Rojo, pendón, negro, color. Luchemos, hermanos, ante la batalla de Bamako.